Good morning. Our third case this morning is 2015-1427, State of Ohio versus Demetrius Jones. The appellant, first we have Mr. Hammond.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Brett Hammond. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney from Cuyahoga County, Ohio. I'm joined at counsel table by Mr. Daniel Van, also from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, and Mr. Samuel Peterson from the Ohio Attorney General's Office. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, at which point Mr. Peterson will have an opportunity to address this court. The state of Ohio is asking this court to reverse and remand the en banc decision of State versus Jones in this case. And there's really three particular reasons why the state is asking this court to reverse and remand that decision. First, the en banc decision in State versus Jones fundamentally changes the test for evaluating claims of pre-indictment delay prejudice. Rather than applying a two-part burden-shifting test, the new test applied by the 8th District Court of Appeals applies a one-part test in which the reasons for the delay are considered as part of whether or not the defendant has suffered actual prejudice. As a part of that argument, the state notes out that it is concerned that speculative claims of prejudice can be raised, which is precisely why the state agrees with the Ohio Attorney General in the briefs that they are when they argue that these claims are best raised post-trial, because it allows an opportunity to clarify whether or not these arguments are speculative or non-speculative.
Counsel, if we can start with that last point first about when it should be considered. Do you have any precedent for the argument you're making?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. We cited to precedent in a number of federal cases, particularly a Fifth Circuit case of Crouch, that it should be considered later on. And the reason for that being is exactly what we have in this case, Your Honor. The second point that I was going to get to, and I'm going to attempt to link them together to your question, is that this is a case where we believe the claims of actual prejudice are speculative. Particularly, the main claim of prejudice that the defendant raises is that the absence of the mother has prejudiced him. Well, what do we actually know in this record about the mother? What we know stems from the original police report. And what we know from that original police report is that the victim was over at the mother's house, and she claims that, or she asserts that the defendant held her at knife point, that the defendant raped her, and that neither the mother nor the brother came to her aid. It's unclear from that statement whether or not the mother and the brother were in the apartment at the time that the crime was committed. They may have been there before, they may have been there afterwards. However, were we to proceed to trial, the victim would testify, and we would know that information, so we'd be able to more fairly evaluate the claim of pre-indictment delay prejudice.
So the police report doesn't indicate whether she was screaming, making noise, etc.
Your Honor, the report does actually indicate that she was screaming and that she was fighting.
However, all right, and then the police report says that she stated that neither the mother and the brother were present and neither came to her aid.
All we know from the report, and based on this limited record in that report, is that she states neither the mother nor the brother came to my aid. We don't know if that means she saw the mother and the brother earlier in the day, that, or if she expected them to be home.
Well, common sense would say that she's mentioning that because they were available to come to her aid. Not that, you know, he has a mother and brother and they weren't, they didn't come to her aid.
Well, Your Honor, I think this is precisely why the record needs to be more developed on this point. Common sense would suggest that if she's screaming for help, then we have a situation where a victim believes she's being raped and she would get some aid from those people. It's unclear, based on the limited record in this case, how long she was in the bedroom. There's evidence outside of the record that both parties had available in terms of how long she was inside the bedroom. And that would help to inform whether or not how likely it was they were there. It's also unclear whether or not she was awake or not. And it's really unclear what the mother would have testified simply based on the narrow and limited record that we have in this case.
But let's just put this in perspective. How long was the time gap between the incident, the report, the police report being taken, and the identification. Well, actually, Mr. Jones was identified at the time, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
He was named, he was identified, his address was known?
Correct.
All right, and then how long did it take to arrest him for this rape?
Your Honor, he was never arrested for this rape. There's some information that is stated in the trial court's opinion. However, we don't have any evidence that he was ever...
He was indicted.
Well, he was later indicted and arrested in 2013.
That's what I mean. I said, how long did it take for him to get arrested and indicted? He wasn't done right at the time, or we wouldn't be here.
I apologize, Your Honor. I misunderstood your question.
Okay.
Yes, there was a 20-year time period between when this initial incident happened and the later arrest of Demetrius Jones.
And what's the reason why, knowing his identity and his address, he was not immediately processed?
Your Honor, all we know from... We really don't know from this record, to be honest. All we know from this record is that the police had information about Jones, the police had information about the mother. They attempted twice to follow up with the mother by phone and then in person, and they made a note that it was a bad address, and until the victim
It was a bad address? You mean where the rape occurred?
In terms of the address that they had for the victim of the rape. They responded to the person's home who had reported the rape, the victim, and it was with respect to that address that they noted it was a bad address at that point.
So what caused the eventual investigation and arrest then of Mr. Jones after 20 years? What was the impetus for that?
Your Honor, really the impetus for it was the Ohio Attorney General's project of testing the backlog of rape kits. Particularly in this case, the rape kit was later submitted in the spring of 2011. Once the kit was submitted, at some point it was tested. Once it was tested, we found that there was a DNA hit going back to DNA that was collected from the defendant back in 2005 when he had been indicted for rape. Part of the reason we're doing this project, even in the cases where we know or have identified who the attacker is because there's been a fundamental shift in understanding how to go about prosecuting these cases and how we treat these cases. When we went ahead and tested the kit, you don't know what you're going to get in the kit until you test it. And so in this case, when we tested the kit, what we learned was that there was a previous case where there's an indictment for a 2005 rape. And then we also got the defendant's criminal history, which indicated that in 2011, he had also again been charged for rape. Now, that was later pled down, but it gave us a more complete story of the defendant at
that point. The 2005 was a different situation, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Not this case.
Not this case, Your Honor. You know, part of the state's concern, though, is even in terms of addressing the reasons for the delay, really, if you get into questions of addressing the reasons of delay without addressing actual prejudice, well, then that's a fundamental shift from the test that this court has applied and all four prior opinions on pre-indictment delay. Adams, Luck, Walls, Whiting, not only that, but it fundamentally shifts from what the U.S. Supreme Court said. It shifts, as the amicus attorney general's brief noted, from every single federal
Counsel,
appellate
your,
decision.
Your basic premise here is that the defendant cannot comply with the first prong of the Luck test, which is demonstrating actual prejudice from the delay. It's speculative.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's our fundamental premise, and moreover than that, besides the fact that it's speculative, I would also point this court to the fact that as this court recently articulated within the last year in State versus Adams in paragraph 103, that the defendant not only has a burden to show that there was lost evidence that was exculpatory, but the defendant also has a burden to show that there's no substitute for this lost evidence. And I think that's particularly critical given the facts of this case, given that the victim in this case made a report that there was someone else in the home, And when that issue was brought up in the March 6, 2014 dismissal hearing, well, what the defense counsel responded definitively is that it was not the brother. Now, the assistant prosecuting attorney pressed on that point and said, well, who was it? And the only response the assistant prosecutor in the court got was, I'm not required to compel this person to come forward. Now, certainly, that's the law. They're not required to compel this person to come forward. However, I would simply submit that if the defendant actually has a burden of demonstrating that there's no substitute testimony, at a minimum, the defendant could have offered something to suggest that either this witness was unavailable, that they couldn't provide comparable testimony, that somehow that it wouldn't, they were unable to bring this person forward.
Counsel, if I may, this is obviously a big case to the people of Ohio. We're looking at a concept where there's a 20-year delay between a crime and a prosecution. And it seems to me that in the Luck case, this Supreme Court said that basic fairness is the standard we're looking for here. And in this particular case, what is the justification for the state not proceeding for 20 years when they knew the identity of the assailant?
Absolutely, Your Honor. First, I'd like to just briefly discuss Luck, and then I'd like to get to the justification for the delay. In the Luck case,
as you do that, are you agreeing with me that the state knew the identity of this defendant 20 years ago?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
And are you agreeing also that witnesses who could have testified are dead?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, in answering that question, what I would point out is that when this court examined the concept of fundamental fairness in Luck, it still applied the two-part burden-shifting test. It looked at first at actual prejudice, then it looked at the state's justification for delay, and based on the defendant being able to meet her burden, and then the state failing to meet its burden, it concluded, based on that test, that it failed fundamental conceptions of justice.
Well,
that burden
let's, if we may, because I'm glad you're here today and I'm glad I'm here today. I used to be a defense counsel.
Yes, sir.
And if I get a case and there are people who could have helped my client 20 years ago and they're dead now, are you saying I have to demonstrate more prejudice than that?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that at all. All I'm saying is that there's a test that considers the fundamental fairness to the defendant and the community, and that test should be applied in this case. And all I'm asking, I'm really not asking this court to create a new test. I'm simply asking this court to employ the test that it's already used, the burden-shifting test, to the facts of these
cases.
Well,
then, not to be argumentative then, is it not your argument that you must make today then? This is fair.
Yes,
what
Your Honor.
What happened here is fair. Yes,
Your Honor. That's our argument we're making. We're saying that, first off, because they have failed to demonstrate actual prejudice, first off, we don't even get to the justifications. However, if we were to address the justifications, the first thing I would like to do is point this court to how the U.S. Supreme Court addressed the issue of justifications of delay. And in Lovasco and Marion, what the court looked at was whether or not the state intentionally delayed for the purpose of gaining advantage. First off, we do not have that in this case. To take it a step further, I think one thing we have to do is we cannot apply the standards of today to understanding what happened at that time when the crime occurred. There is a reason that this is a national crisis. There's a reason that this goes beyond Cuyahoga County, Ohio. And it has to do with three things. It has to do with the differences in technology. It has to do with the differences in police resources. And it also has to do with the fundamental shift in understanding how we need to deal with rape crimes.
And counsel, in this particular case, though, this was 1993.
Correct.
And they knew that Demetrius Jones was an individual who was accused of rape by this victim. A week later, they closed the case. The police closed the case. Say, we can't do any more, we got a bad address, whatever. 2005, he's picked up and indicted for rape again. Was that in Cuyahoga County?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, was that in Cleveland?
I believe it was. I don't have that case in front of me, but I believe so.
So they've got this name of Demetrius Jones. I would presume that they were running records at that time. They would have seen you know, based on their own records, that Mr. Jones was a rape suspect in a previous case. And then you said in 2011, there was another hit, another rape by this same individual.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the police didn't put together 93, 2005, and 2011. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is I think it's certainly regrettable that we've waited to this point to go ahead and prosecute this case. However,
you didn't need the rape kit to prosecute the case.
Well, we did need to follow.
You didn't need the rape kit test to prosecute the case. You had the name. You had him picked up and in custody. Presumably, you had evidence, physical evidence of a rape, so you had DNA. You knew you had this rape kit sitting on the shelf someplace. You go pick up the rape kit, you match it against the new rape kit, and you've got Mr. Jones.
Your Honor, what I would point out is that the state certainly doesn't have any incentive in terms of being able to successfully prosecute these cases to delay. As this court stated in State versus...
I'm not saying you did it purposely. I'm not saying the police did it purposely whatsoever.
Your Honor, all I'm saying is that delay also prejudices us as well, that it goes both ways, as this court articulated in State versus Keenan. We want to have the ability to have the ripped clothing because we believe we have a valid report of rape. So it goes, the prejudice really goes both ways. And the idea of fundamental fairness has established a two-part burden-shifting test that really considers fairness to both parties. It considers fairness to the defendant and fairness to the state, and it does it by—
Are you arguing that the Court of Appeals applied the right standard or the wrong standard?
Your Honor, I'm definitively arguing that the Court of Appeals applied the wrong standard in evaluating claims of pre-indictment delay prejudice.
And what standard should it have articulated?
It should have articulated the same standard embraced in this court in Adams, Luck, Walls, and Whiting, which is a two-part burden-shifting test that says that first, it's the defendant's burden to establish substantial and actual prejudice.
So you want this case sent back to the appellate court with instructions to apply the proper standard. Is that what your argument is?
This court certainly could do that. However, I think under the facts of this case, this court could also reverse and remand and say that there has been no demonstration of substantial actual prejudice. And part of the reason I say that is if you look at the opinion.
You want us to do the weighing in the first instance under the proper standard.
Yes, Your Honor, we're asking you to do both. And I think you can, because what's interesting in the Court of Appeals opinion is when they looked at the whole record, they said that it's completely speculative what the mother would have said.
Thank
at that point, the inquiry really should end.
Thank you.
Thank you, your time is up. Mr. Bensing.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, my name is Russ Bensing. I'm the attorney for Demetrius Jones. We're here today because they claim that I have to tell you exactly what a dead woman would have testified to. As Justice O'Neill pointed out, the reason that we don't know what she would have testified to is because of them. Had they done a minimally competent investigation of this case, that woman would have testified back in 1993 or 1994, and we wouldn't be here today.
But you don't know what she would have said.
No, I don't know what she would have said.
So if the test in Luck is to show actual prejudice, not speculative prejudice, how is her unavailability actual prejudice? Because she may come forward and say, yeah, my son's a rapist, and I'm afraid of him, and he carries a knife.
Yeah, but if you look at Luck, the prejudice in Luck was no more than what it is here. You had a missing witness, a dead witness, Cassano. Nobody testified what he was going to testify to. The only statement that you had by the defendant was that he would have been able to help her because he was there at the scene.
But there was also another person at the scene.
Yes. No, okay. No. You're talking about here.
Yeah, in
okay.
Your case, not
okay.
Luck. Not
okay.
Luck.
Well,
but in your case, there's another adult at the scene.
Well, let me address that point because that's key here. First of all, it was not his brother, okay?
Okay. That's fine.
I've talked to the defense attorney about this, and this isn't part of the record here, but as he did indicate on the record, this was another person. Nobody has any idea what happened to this other person, whether he was in fact there, other than what the victim says. So we don't, that's a complete red herring here. It's not like we're sitting here saying, well, yeah, there was another person there. He could present testimony. We have no idea.
How do you know the mother was there?
What?
How do you know the mother was there?
It's her apartment.
Well, that doesn't mean anything.
Well,
the front door, isn't there?
Well, the victim stated that the mother was there, okay. And she stated that there were two people there. We have no idea who that other person is. We know it's not his brother. We don't know if it was the mother's brother. We have no idea who he is, where he is, if he's still alive, or anything else. I don't think it's reasonable for us to be able to show that nobody else in the world could testify in this case. We can't find this guy. We don't know where this guy is.
Counsel, if I may interrupt you on that, I'd like to direct your attention to the legal standard that your opposing counsel talked about. I think everybody in the room will applaud the fact that technology has gone so far that DNA testing now is bringing bad guys to justice that we didn't know their names 20 years ago, and they're going to jail. That's not this case. And it looks to me like the Court of Appeals said, go to the terms of basic concepts of due process and fundamental justice. Is that the right standard for the Court of Appeals to have used?
I think that the appropriate standard is the standard that you used in Luck. You do have to find actual prejudice. And I do think you do have actual prejudice in this. You have the same actual prejudice you had in Luck. You had a missing witness, a dead witness who was there at the time of the offense and who could have given testimony as to the defendant's argument of self-defense. Here, the defendant had only an argument of consent, and that's not his burden to prove as it was in Luck, but his only witness to support that defense was dead. And I would also point out in connection with Chief Justice O'Connor's questions about what happened in 2005, the mother was still alive then. She could have testified even if they brought the case at that time. Now let's address the actual prejudice standard, because I think this is the real crux of this case. We're not talking about unjustifiable delay here. There's no question this is an unjustifiable delay. So let's talk about actual prejudice, and let's start with the case law, because the state and its amicus have amassed a seemingly formidable array of some 53 cases saying that the actual prejudice has to be concrete, specific, non-speculative, and so forth. And I think the first thing that I'd note here is that this case should be decided under the Ohio Constitution. They've cited 19 federal cases for that proposition. But the key thing that you have to realize about those federal cases, in every one of those 19 cases, the statute of limitations was 5 years. Now, if you go from the proposition that the primary protection against delayed prosecution is the statute of limitations, a 5-year statute of limitations is a pretty good defense. Now, I think that the law on this area in the federal courts, and keep in mind we're just talking about the federal circuits, which don't bind you. The Supreme Court has never ruled in that fashion. If you look at the federal courts, I think their law would have developed much differently if they were dealing with a 20, 25, and possibly 30-year statute of limitations rather than a 5-year limitation period. I think their law would have developed much differently if they were facing something like a 20-year delay rather than the 30-month delay that was the average in those 19 cases. And I think they would have been dealing, that law would have developed much differently if they were dealing with the situation here where you have just totally incompetent police work. In 10 of those 19 cases, they went on to look at whether the delay was justifiable, and in every case they held it wasn't, because the case was under investigation at that time.
Counsel, where's your client now?
What's that?
Where's your client now?
I think he's in, I think he's in prison, Your Honor.
Okay, and how long has he been in prison?
That I do not know. I know that he was not convicted in the 2000, he was acquitted in the 2011 matter.
Okay, but he was convicted on the earlier one?
I don't believe, I think that he was convicted of something in the 2005 matter.
So if he had, if he'd been prosecuted in a timely fashion, he would have, what, served consecutive or concurrent sentences? Is that?
If he would have been convicted in this matter, he would have, he may have served consecutive or concurrent sentences. The other one was 5 years, that was in 2005, 12 years later. So I really couldn't tell you on that. But getting back to what I was indicating.
So that's not part of his prejudice here, that, gee, if it got me back when I did it, these could have all run together. Huh?
There was actually one case that they cite where that's what the defendant argued, that if he'd been prosecuted way back then, he would have done his time and he'd be out now. And obviously that's not actual prejudice. But going back to the federal cases, again, the federal courts are facing situations far differently than the Ohio courts are, and that's why I think that you should use the Ohio Constitution in analyzing the due process claim. Now, let's.
So, if I can stop you there, I guess I'm confused about one point. I think in response to at least one other question, you agreed the Court of Appeals got it wrong. The Court of Appeals used the wrong standard. So, at least in that sense, don't we have to remand it? Or
no,
what
I
you're
don't.
Saying is we need to use, yes, they got it wrong, but we can use the right test and come out different and still affirm the result. Is that what you're asking us to do?
I think that that's exactly what I'm asking you to do. I think that you can find actual prejudice here. There's no question about the unjustifiable delay. If you use the same test that you used in Luck, I think that the defense prevails in this case.
But you don't have to get to the unjustifiable delay if you find, if we find that there was no actual prejudice.
That is correct. If you, there has to be some finding of actual prejudice. Now, I mean, look, Jones didn't come out the way it would have if I'd written it, but they don't let me do that sort of thing on those rare occasions when I win cases. I think that the decision in Jones had its heart in the right place, that what you look at here is the fundamental fairness, because that's what we're talking about with due process. And we get so caught up.
You don't have to go there. You just have to look at actual prejudice, not fundamental fairness or any of that. The test is very clear. Was there actual prejudice here to your client?
Yes, I think there was.
I know you're saying that,
yes.
But then you're saying, well, you know, their heart was in the right place, and why don't we look at fundamental fairness here too, and that goes more towards the delay argument than it does to the actual prejudice argument.
No, I think once you get to the actual prejudice, and as I said, I think we do get actual prejudice, there are a number of court decisions which hold that you then compare the prejudice to the delay and analyze the two of them in terms of fundamental fairness. That's what the Court of Appeals did in the 8th District in McFeature, and there is some case law from other courts that have applied the same test.
What findings did the trial court make with respect to actual prejudice, and what did you evidence to the court as a result of the delay?
Well, the first thing the court found was
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. The first thing the court found was the death of the mother, that actually prejudiced the defendant because his key witness for a consent defense was not there. And I think that the court made a couple of other findings. One was the faded memories, the loss of time. And if that had been the only thing that the court had found, I don't think that constitutes actual prejudice. There is case law that says that merely the fading of that, merely fading memories or loss of time isn't sufficient. But I think in consideration of the other factors.
Did the state rebut those arguments?
They never rebutted the fact that the woman was dead.
But they didn't know, and you don't know, and no one knew what she was going to say. They're presuming, the court, and the appellate court, is presuming she would have been a defense witness and be, you know, the witness that would have said, yeah, it was consensual.
Yeah, and just as you presumed in Luck that Cassano would have done what the defendant claimed that he would do and come in and testify, yeah, it was in self-defense. That's the same presumption you made in Luck. And, you know, when you talk about, like I said, what they're claiming is that I have to tell you specifically what she would have said when they're the reason that we don't know what she would have said. And I don't think that that complies with any concept of fundamental fairness here. I think that for actual prejudice, if you look at the totality of the trial, what would have happened in this trial? And I would disagree with you respectfully, Chief Justice. I don't think we have to wonder what she was going to testify to. She's the guy's mother. She's not going to show up on the state's witness list. And she would have come in, she would have testified, and the jury would have had an opportunity to view her credibility, to determine her credibility, and it would have decided either number one, that she was covering for her son, or number two, that it didn't happen, that she was credible, and that it was a consensual sexual act if it was a,
Okay, Mr. Bensing, turning to the second part,
put
actual prejudice to the side for the moment. You have said a couple of times that there's no question that delay was unjustifiable.
Yes.
Now, if I listen to Mr. Hammond, he said that he disputed that, saying that you had to show intentional delay to gain advantage. And there was no showing that the state intentionally wanted to delay this case to gain any advantage over the defense.
No, but you had departed from that in Luck. There, the same thing had occurred, that the state just dropped the ball on the investigation for no reason whatsoever. They stopped investigating the crime.
So you expanded that in Luck to
include that situation where
that's,
the state
that's
simply
my question. You're saying that there's a different, you have a different definition of unjustifiable delay.
And that's the definition.
And you're just saying what, it's the length of time? Is that the only thing?
No.
What else is unjustifiable delay?
What is unjustifiable about this is that the police detective in charge of investigating this case put about as much effort into it as I do in grocery shopping every weekend. He made two efforts, and it takes up a total of 28 words in his police report. He knocked on the door, went to the address, knocked on the door, he called the phone number, nobody answered, and he closed the file. Now, he had the mother's address. The police reports indicate that the mother, the victim's mother, took her to the hospital. In fact, the police met them at the mother's house. He had the mother's address, the mother's phone number. He never made any effort to contact her. He didn't do anything. And if you look, I think it's on page 34 of the transcript, the prosecutor admitted that, yeah, he attempted to contact her twice. He did nothing else. And I don't think under any conceivable stretch that could be considered as anything other than unjustifiable delay.
So cold case file investigation of this type, where 20 years later a rape kit provides a hit toward a defendant and the case is reopened, how does that play into your to the issue of unjustifiable delay?
This wasn't a cold case. They had his name, they had his address, they had where it occurred. They had that all from day one. On September 2nd of 1993, the police had all that information. The detective closed out the file 5 days later. They had everything they needed to have there. This is not going to affect every case of rape kits here. It's going to affect very few of them, because the only ones it's going to affect are those where there's a potential consent defense. If it's a stranger rape, this isn't going to have any effect on those cases.
Did the trial court apply the Luck standard in its analysis?
I don't think it specifically referred to it, but it referred numerous times to the fact that this woman is dead. We don't...
Well, I know the facts, but I mean,
yeah.
I'm concerned more about the standard that the trial court applied. Was it an actual prejudice standard?
Yes, it was an actual prejudice standard.
Well,
he said specifically
then the Court of Appeals changed the standard.
They found actual prejudice, too. The only thing the Court of Appeals did was it balanced the prejudice and the unjustifiable delay together to determine that there was a due process violation.
Thank you. The
trial court found found both actual prejudice and unjustifiable delay. The trial court applied the correct standard. Now, getting back to your question, Justice Lanzinger, I think that tactical advantage part here, the test in Marion and Lovasco becomes critical, because in Marion they say that, well, the unjustifiable delay is where the state delays the case in order to obtain a tactical advantage over the defendant. Here there was no intent to do that, but the effect was the same. They achieved an enormous tactical advantage over the defendant. They had a situation now with the rape kit. They could prove that sexual activity took place. His only defense to that was consent, and all of his evidence of that was gone. They were going to try him in a situation 20 years later where they had the evidence to convict him and he had no evidence with which to defend himself. And that is fundamentally unfair. And I would submit that we do have the actual prejudice here. And the comment that the prejudice goes both ways, well, the problem is the consequences of a wrong result here do not cut equally. If the prosecution loses a case, it loses a case. If the defense loses a case, he goes to prison. If the prosecution gets the wrong result from the jury, then perhaps a guilty man goes free. If the jury gets it wrong, if the defendant gets convicted when he should have been acquitted, then an innocent man goes to prison, and we protect the latter scenario much more so than we do the former scenario.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, you've used your time, or I should say your co-counsel used their time, so you can take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. This case really can begin and end with the court's decision in Adams from October of last year. That decision shows three things. It shows, one, why the defendant has not proven actual prejudice in this case. It shows, two, why his interpretation of Luck is incorrect. And it shows, three, why there is no independent Ohio constitutional right to a separate or looser standard for governing pre-indictment delay. I'd like to begin with the very first point, which is the requirement that you show actual prejudice through concrete and specific evidence. And in Adams, this court cited the Sixth Circuit's decision in Rogers, where the Sixth Circuit had said specifically what my friend says he cannot show, which is when you have a witness who is deceased, you must show to establish actual prejudice what that witness would have said. And I also, the United States Sixth Circuit decision, United States v. Montgomery, the court quoted, where it said, yes, the burden on a defendant seeking to prove pre-indictment delay violated due process is almost nearly insurmountable, especially because proof of prejudice is always speculative.
Well, how do you square then the Rogers, where you said that the defendant had the burden of showing what the deceased would have said in this case with the Luck case, where I've heard that they were unable to show, didn't show, what that witness would have said?
I think, Your Honor, looking at the decision in Luck from its face, it is at most ambiguous about what the evidence was in that case. We don't have the benefit of the record that the Luck court would have had. But if you look, there is some indication that the deceased witness was at one time a prime suspect. So there was actually other evidence available, certainly in the record, of what that witness may have been, what led the police to believe that deceased witness was a prime suspect. Certainly there was the statements of the defendant in Luck that the other person was present in the room at the time that the crime happened and was the only person that could have saved her. And so that is, even if that is not enough, under certain standards, I think certain federal courts may still say that was not enough. It's still more than is in the record here, where there, if you look on page 20 of my friend's brief, he says there's simply no way to know what the mother would have said. If you look on page 13, I believe, he speculates about what she may have said, but then said, well, she may have refuted or may have confirmed what the defendant's story was. And so here, even taking a loose interpretation and favorable interpretation of Luck, there was more evidence than is present in this case.
So is there gradation here? For example, if in this case originally the defendant said, I did not have sex with that woman, and the rape kit 20 years later proves otherwise, then you have somebody that was at the house at the same time, and the argument is, who's now deceased, the argument is that she could have contributed to the idea that it was consensual, when in fact the defendant had said, I never had sex with that woman.
I think the important thing, Your Honor, in response to the consent or non-consent question is there is no statement from before the rape kit ever came back that this was consensual. So he's only making the claim of consent after being faced with the evidence that it was indeed, there was sexual conduct and it was his material that was in the rape kit.
But and if he had said initially it was consensual, then that other person who was there at the time of the event would arguably be important.
It may be important, Your Honor, but in order to actually establish actual prejudice under this court's decision in Adams, under Marion and Levasco from the U.S. Supreme Court, and the vast wealth of federal and state court authority, that would not be sufficient to show actual prejudice. And I know I have used up the time, so thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, that concludes our oral arguments for this morning. Marshall, will you please adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable.